Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. My name is Joe Epstein. I'm a past chair of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors, and I'll be your chair for tonight's program. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. This program is part of the club's Good Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. And today's program will feature a conversation about America's educational system with Michelle Rhee, founder and CEO of Students First and former chancellor of the District of Columbia system and author of the new book, Radical, Fighting to Put Students First. Ms. Rhee will be in conversation with Professor Kirk Hansen, the executive director of the Markkula Center for Applied Ethics at Santa Clara University and a member of the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Let me now tell you a little bit more about Ms. Rhee. During her controversial tenure as chancellor of the D.C. school system, Michelle Rhee closed underperforming schools, 23 schools alone, as a matter of fact, in 2008. She trimmed waste from the central bureaucracy and fired large numbers of ineffective teachers based in part on controversial standardized tests. Many of us have followed Michelle's highly visible career, particularly since the movie Waiting for Superman, but let me just tell you a little bit about her early years. Michelle was born on Christmas Day in 1969 in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Her father was a physician, and her mother owned a clothing store. She was raised in Toledo, Ohio, and educated in the public schools in K through 6. Her parents then sent her to South Korea to attend school for 1 year, and upon her return, she enrolled in a private school. She received her BA in government from Cornell and a master's of public policy from the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. Michelle joined Teach for America and taught in the Baltimore Public Schools for 3 years. In 1997, she founded and served as CEO of the New Teacher Project, which trained and supplied urban school districts with 23,000 mid-career classroom teachers. And in 2010, she started a grassroots organization called Students First. Former New York City Chancellor Joe Klein said this of Michelle: "What she did in Washington, D.C. was game-changing, which is precisely the kind of bold leadership this country needs." Please welcome Michelle Rhee and Professor Kirk Hansen.
Michelle, I'm delighted to be in conversation with you. The Washington Post called your new book, Radical, a memoir slash manifesto. I'd like to focus first on the manifesto part and your diagnosis of the problems of American education system, and then look at some of the memoir kinds of points.
Sure.
I have some questions, but we're going to be getting questions from the audience for discussion as well, and I will add those to the ones that I have, try to ask as many as we can. You obviously have tremendous experience in different aspects of American education. Can you give us your basic diagnosis of what leads to low performance of American schools today?
So that's always a tough question, and the reason why I am a little loath to answer it is because people are always looking for both simplistic, problems and simplistic answers. And the bottom, and you know, I can't tell you the number of calls that I get from governors who say, "Okay, I can only do one thing. What should I do?" And their hope is that by doing that one thing, it's going to change the system, the school system in their state, and it's just not possible to do. So I'm always a little hesitant, but I will say this, given my experiences, is that if I had to boil things down to one issue, it would be the complete and utter lack of accountability. that exist in public schools today. When I went to D.C. Originally, I, you know, was an unlikely pick. I was a 37-year-old Korean girl from Toledo, Ohio, who had never run a school, much less a school district. So when my boss, Adrian Fenty, announced that I was going to be the city's first schools chancellor, the system was pretty much in shock. I mean, the entire city, you know, was thinking, gosh, what on God's green earth was Adrian Fenty thinking? And that's pretty much what was going through my head when I was sitting, you know, in the office on the first day. And I'm trying to figure out, you know, where do you start when the system is as broken as it is? And as I started looking through sort of what was going on and what some of the problems were, it was interesting because one of my assistants had an experience where he was trying to find out, you know, what were we spending money on and why, and it turned out that a tremendous amount of money was being spent sending special education students to private schools because we could not meet their needs in the public school system, and then their parents would sue us, and then the court remedy would be that they got sent to a private school and we had to pay the tuition. I had never heard of anything like that before. So, you know, I said, well, I need to understand how something like this happens. So my assistant says, well, you know, let me just give you one example. He said, I found a woman who works for us. She's just a mid-level bureaucrat. In 1 week, she made two mistakes. She didn't fill out a form she was supposed to fill out on one kid. And with another kid, she didn't have a meeting she was supposed to have. And in both of these circumstances, it resulted in these two kids getting sent to a private school that costs this district $224,000 per kid per year. And I thought, that's the craziest thing I've ever heard. So I said, well, I need to meet this woman. So he calls the lady up and he says, you know, ma'am, I'd like you to come to a meeting at the chancellor's office tomorrow at 5 o'clock. And the lady says, well, I'm going to have to check with my supervisor on that. And my assistant said, ma'am, the chancellor is your supervisor. She's everyone's supervisor. And then the lady says, well, I'm going to have to check with my lawyer then, or bring my lawyer. He said, bring whoever you want, just show up at 5 o'clock. So the next day rolls around, 5 o'clock, I sit down. I said, so I understand that you had a question about whether you should come today. She said, no, I got a little freaked out, but I'm okay now. I said, okay. I said, you know, so pull out the files. And I said, so this person, this kid, you didn't have the meeting, this kid, you didn't fill out the form. I said, with two mistakes, you cost this district nearly $500,000. Help me understand how that happened. She looked at me and she said, well, you need to understand that I am a very busy person. She said, I got lots of kids on my caseload. I have so many meetings to go to and forms to fill out. Things are going to fall through the cracks. That's just the way it is. And I looked at her and I said, no, you need to understand that if you think this job is too big for you, then you need to go find another job. I said, but if you are going to take the paycheck home every other week, then you have to take personal responsibility for doing everything within your job purview and doing it well. She looks at me and she said, but that's not fair. I kid you not. That was her answer. And through weeks of having discussions with people in the school district, that was the overarching sentiment of people was, I'll come in, I'll punch in at 9, I'll punch out at 5. There was no understanding of the fact that they were responsible for doing certain things and that they had to do those things well for kids. And so that's what, in my mind, created a system, an entire system. It wasn't just, you know, central office bureaucrats or principals or teachers. It was an entire system that was absolutely oriented towards the wrong thing and where there was absolutely no accountability for producing results for kids.
Let's try to take that apart and talk about both teachers and administrators. To what extent is that a teacher problem? You've said there's nothing more important than the quality of the teachers that teach our children. Are the teachers the primary problem, or are the administrators the primary problem, or is it both?
So I would actually say that there is no shortage of effective educators in our country who can innovate, who can do the right thing. And I also think that every kid in this country, regardless of the circumstances from which they come every day, can achieve at high levels if we put them in the right school environment. So the problem is not with the educators, the teachers, the kids. The problem is that everyone is forced to operate in an insane bureaucracy that is driven by antiquated rules and policies. And so when you have either an ineffective principal or an ineffective teacher, the rules of the bureaucracy say that you can't get rid of them. And on the flip side, when you have a great teacher or a great principal, we make lives, their lives so miserable that the likelihood that they would want to stay and continue that work is just isn't there. So I'll give you one quick example. Here in California, as in many states across the country, we have a law on the books that says in the time of layoffs, if we have a budget crisis and we have to lay teachers off, we must lay teachers off by strict seniority, which means last in, first out. If you're the last person hired, you must be the first person fired regardless of your performance. And so what that has caused in this state are stories all up and down the state of California where a teacher gets their plaque for being Teacher of the Year one day, and the next day they are handed a pink slip. And it makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. I mean, if our job is to educate kids well, and we know that of all of the in-school factors that exist, that teacher quality is the most important factor, then shouldn't we be doing everything within our power to keep great teachers in the classroom? But we have a law that says it doesn't matter if you're great or not. If you came in last, you got to go. And when you create that kind of an environment, then effective teachers who are knocking it out for kids every day, they're seeing huge results, but they're not paid based on those results, and they have no job security based on those results, it's not creating the kind of profession that great people want to stay in the long term.
Where are we today on teacher assessment? We've had many national debates. You certainly have fought that battle in D.C. Where are we today? Have we made any progress on that?
We actually have. And by we, I mean we as a nation. We as California have not. And so let me give you a quick overview of where we are. In D.C. about 4 years ago, we implemented a new teacher evaluation system where 50% of the evaluation was going to be based on student achievement growth. And we did that because when I got to the district, I found a situation where 8% of the children in the city's schools that were in eighth grade were operating on grade level in mathematics, 8%, which means that 92% of our kids did not have the skills and knowledge necessary to be productive members of society. And yet when I looked at the performance evaluations of the adults in the system at the same time, it showed that 98% of them were being rated as doing an excellent job. You cannot run an effective organization when there is that huge a disconnect between how you're evaluating people and what they're producing in terms of their success for students. So we said there's got to be alignment. We've got to evaluate teachers at least partly on whether or not their kids are moving academically. So we put this in place, and since then, and mostly because of the Race to the Top initiative from the Obama administration, now 38 states across the country have agreed to adopt teacher evaluation systems that count student achievement growth as part of the overall evaluation. Now, of the 12 states that have refused to do this, one of them is our state of California. But not only is California just saying we're not going to do this, there was actually legislation introduced to the legislature last year that would have made it illegal to count student achievement growth as part of a teacher's evaluation. So the entire nation is moving one direction, and California is moving in the opposite direction. And what I think is fascinating about all of this is you, because I now live in Sacramento, and my husband, when I started the organization and we were trying to figure out where to headquarter, we were talking about Chicago and New York, and I was already in D.C., and he said to me, "You got to come to the belly of the beast, baby." if you can crack Sacramento open, you can crack the whole thing open. So we have headquartered in Sacramento. I've had lots of conversations with legislators, and it's fascinating because one of the huge problems that exists in this country is that the people who are responsible for making the laws and policies are far too willing to make those decisions based on interests that have nothing to do with kids. So when we were in D.C., we implemented this new teacher evaluation program, and then we had data about how effective teachers were. And then when we had a layoff, we decided we were going to do that layoff based on quality, not seniority. So 266, most of them were some of the worst teachers in the district, got laid off. One of the politicians, came to me and said, I am going to demand that you reinstate every single one of the wrongly terminated 266 teachers today. And I looked at him and I said, I'll tell you what. You have four kids, and they do not attend the D.C. public schools. So if you agree to bring one of your kids back into the system and agree for them to be taught by one of the ineffective teachers that I have just fired, then I will give that person their job back. And if you bring all four of your kids, I will bring four of those teachers back. And you can, your cousins, your uncles, kids, whoever, all your family, as long as you bring them into the system and let them be taught by these teachers, then I will hire every single one of them back. Guess what? He didn't take me up on that. Why? Because these folks are willing to subject the public to things that they would never allow for their own children. And therein lies the huge problem in our system right now.
How do you diagnose California in those terms? What leads to the political opposition here that you saw reflected in the bill introduced last year and so on?
I mean, this is the good news is that it's very easy to diagnose. This is all about politics, and it's all about transactions. And it doesn't really have to do with what is in the best interest of kids, or even what we as the constituents want. I mean, in addition to last year's lovely let's move in the other direction on teacher evaluation, there was also a bill that was introduced to the legislature that would have allowed it to be easier for school districts to fire teachers who were found to be sexual predators. Now, if ever there was a definition of low-hanging fruit, folks, it ought to be passing that law. It didn't even make it out of committee. Not even to a vote of the couldn't even make it out of committee. When the CTA decided that they did not want to pass that law, they've talked to the people on the committee. They all worked it out. Who's going to stay? Well, I mean, this is my conjecture. You know, who's going to vote yes? Who's going to vote no? The bottom line is it wouldn't move. And normally when that kind of thing happens in Sacramento, there's no accountability. You guys don't look at the agenda of the education committee hearings and know what's on there and know who's voting for what. You have no idea. And so what happens is these laws, you know, that these pieces of legislation that absolutely ought to be implemented get squashed through one political process or another, then we, as the citizens, aren't paying attention. We're not holding these elected officials accountable, and so it can continue forever. And that's part of the reason why we started Students First, was to shine a light on these issues and to tell everyday people, these are the folks who would not vote for this law. Are you going to elect them to another term? And unless that kind of accountability happens for our politicians, nothing will change.
You mentioned the CTA, California Teachers Association, and you certainly had your run-ins with the unions in D.C. What's your sense of what's happened since 2010 in terms of the unions nationally, attitudes towards teacher evaluation? Is there an improvement? Do you see progress?
So the quick answer is no. But let me explain myself a little bit. I run into a lot of people as I'm talking nationally about these issues who want to say to me, well, it's the teachers' union. They are the problem. If we didn't have unions, then things would be so much better. And there's sort of a real heavy emphasis on how do we change unions. And in my mind, that is absolutely the wrong emphasis. The purpose of a teachers' union is to protect the rights, privileges, and pay of their members. They are doing a wonderful job of that. And so you can't begrudge them the fact that they're doing exactly what they are chartered to do. we can't expect that all of a sudden they're going to say, yes, we want to adopt a teacher evaluation system that will identify people who will be low performers who will then be like, oh, then they're not doing their job. They're not protecting the jobs of their members at that point. So in my mind, the issue is not that teachers' unions exist. The problem to date has been that you've had these incredibly powerful teachers' unions that have lots of resources, and they use those resources to have influence on the political process, which they've done a magnificent job of. And we don't have, or we haven't until we started Students First, we haven't had an organized national interest group that was advocating on behalf of children who had this equivalent resources and people to mobilize. So when you don't have that, then you end up with a really skewed landscape and environment towards those special interests. And what we really need to do is even that out.
There's a bit of disbelief in a couple of the questions that, given how bad things are, the statistics you've cited from our OECD standing of 25th out of 34 developed countries and all of the other statistics, that there isn't more outrage in the country and there isn't more resolve than you document. What's your diagnosis of all of us, those who don't bring about the change that seems to be so necessary? Here in California, of course, it's added to with the economic stakes that are involved, that the workforce is so important to our economic future.
So it always amazes me when I look at what's happening to children in classrooms every day across this country, that there isn't more outrage. And it's not just, you know, oh, do you care about the children who are getting a, you know, not so good education? That's one thing, and some people that resonates with. But I'm talking about from just more of a purely sort of, good government sort of point of view. So I'll give you a quick example, which I use in my book as well, which is of the rubber rooms in New York City. I don't know if you know about these or not, but what happened in New York City was that Joel Klein, who's a hero of mine, was the chancellor of the New York City school system. And he was locked in a negotiation with the teachers' union over their collective bargaining agreement. And what Joel wanted was to give principals the right to hire the teachers that they wanted in the school, to basically choose who they wanted, because that was not happening. You got people forced into your school. You had no say. If they had seniority and they chose your school, then they had a job, and it didn't matter whether you wanted them or not. So that's what Joel wanted. And then the second thing that he wanted was that if, after everybody interviewed and the principals chose their teachers, there were teachers who could not find a placement, that he would be able to let them go from the system. So those were the two things he was after. An independent arbitration panel actually granted him the first, but not the second. So principals were able to choose their own teachers, but what ended up at the end of the shuffle was there were all these people left that couldn't find a position, and yet the system could not move them out. And so they were just there, remained on the payroll. Some of these people were people who were found to have done, all sorts of things, passed out drunk on the floor in the classroom and everything else, and yet we couldn't fire them. And so because the school district was continuing to pay them, they would make these folks come into a room every day, sign in for 6.5 hours. They were allowed to do whatever they want. So they have footage of this, and some people are sleeping, and some people are playing cards or watching movies all day long, getting paid $90,000 a year. This whole debacle cost that district $100 million a year. So just from the taxpayer standpoint, how is there not any outrage around the fact that $100 million of their taxpayer dollars were spent for people to come and play Sudoku all day long? And mind you, it's $100 million that then isn't going into the classroom. So when this came out, they wrote a New Yorker article about it or what, but there was no organized, mobilized outrage to demand something different. And that, I think, is part of the problem, is that we hear these things, we read it in the New Yorker, we shake our heads and think, this is crazy. And then you go back to work or whatever you have to do. And until we're able to mobilize everyday citizens like yourself who go to work every day, so you can't, you know, show up at the legislature every day or whatever. But we've got to find a way to ensure that your voices are heard in this so that you can express your outrage, your dissatisfaction, to let people know that this kind of thing cannot continue. Because until that happens, until that kind of organization happens, then nothing will change.
Let me remind our radio audience that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our guest is former Washington, D.C. Schools Chancellor Michelle Rhee, who is giving her perspective on how to improve education in America. There are two or three questions about, well, how do you do teacher evaluation then? How much on school, on student performance? How much on other factors?
Sure. So what we advocate at Students First is that 50% of the evaluation should be based on academic growth of kids. And of that 50%, it has to be done through a value-added growth model, which ensures that it is fair to teachers and transparent. And let me explain to you what that means. That means that you don't say, well, how did your kids score at the end of the year on the assessment, and then for people whose classroom scored high, then you get a good evaluation. Because for some teachers, you inherit a classroom at the beginning of the year where 95% of the kids are already on grade level. And a teacher three blocks away might inherit a classroom of kids where 10% of them are on grade level at the beginning of the year. And you don't have different starting points, so you can't expect the same ending point. So you have to have a model that measures where the children are when they start the school year, where they are when they end the school year, and we have to see growth, which most teachers will say, that's fair. You also have to control out for factors that are outside of the purview of teachers, so things like socioeconomic status, special education status, ELL. Those are things that teachers can't control. Attendance, right? If you can't control, the teachers can't control it, then we can't weigh it in part of the model. So it should control for all of those factors. But you can do that and come up with a sort of true look at how much value that particular teacher added. So that's one piece of it, and that's 50%. The other 50% we believe should be a combination of observations of classroom practice, where people are going into their classroom and seeing what they're doing every day, contributions to school community. So you know the teachers that take the kids on college visits and coach the soccer team and the debate team and are taking kids out every weekend. That should count for something. And then the last piece, and this is probably the most interesting, is that recently data and research has shown that how children rate their teachers, is actually very, very highly correlated to that teacher's performance. In fact, the surveys of kids is more highly correlated to teacher performance than the observations of the principals. Why? Because when the principal says, next Tuesday, I'm going to come into your classroom and observe you, then you can put on the dog and pony show for an hour. And you know, the kids see you every day, not just on the special days. And so those are some of the factors that we think should be a part of a holistic look. It is very important, I think, to note this, that that I don't think any professional of any profession should ever be evaluated based on just one thing. And the same is true of teachers. So you have to create a model that looks through multiple lenses at that person's effectiveness.
Two questions asking whether you hold out any hope for teacher union involvement in constructing those assessment systems. Have you gotten engagement from the unions in that process? Do you hold out hope for it? Do you have teachers involved in the constructing of those measures?
So I think that teachers should be more involved. In fact, when we were in D.C., we had a unique and important provision within the city charter that said that we did not have to collectively bargain the evaluation tool, that it was a right of management, which I actually think was very important. But we wanted to have teacher input in the development of it. So we held hundreds and hundreds of focus groups and work groups with teachers to determine how to do this. And the quality of the engagement and the feedback that we were getting was so good. I mean, these were individual teachers who just said, what would I want in an evaluation system? How could I get professional development out of this? What would be valuable to me? As opposed to the union leadership who's, well, how can we create a system where nobody ever gets fired, right? Very different focus. And so we got, I think, a tremendous amount of feedback, and I think that should always be the case. Whenever any state or school district is going to implement a new evaluation tool, they absolutely should take what the teachers are saying into account. The teachers' unions, I think, are a different breed, and one of the things that has been frustrating to me is that. Well, so I get called a lot of names, and people say a lot of things about me. But one of the more popular things that the people that don't like me say about me is, she wants to evaluate teachers solely on the basis of test scores. And it scares the bejesus out of teachers. I mean, I talk to teachers all the time, and they say, yeah, but you want to evaluate us just on the test scores? And I say, no, I don't. They say, what do you mean? And when I tell them, they say, oh. And what's interesting is, so what we advocate for is 50% of the evaluation based on student achievement levels. The AFT, the national AFT, was participating in and approved a teacher evaluation system in Connecticut where 35% of the evaluation is based on student growth. So is that what we're talking about? 15% difference? Because if it is, then what we ought to do is sit down and have a productive conversation about that 15%. Because we could say something like, okay, let's choose 30 cities. We'll do 10 at 35% and 10 at 40% and 10 at 50%. And then we'll see what the outcomes are and we'll go from there, right? I mean, it's very reasonable, but that kind of dialogue is not happening. It's always turned into these like polarized debates around these extremes where actually nobody is. And so I probably may not be the first person that they would want to sit down with to have this conversation, but until we get to that level of discussion, I think we're going to have a hard time really moving the ball forward.
I want to go back now to the memoir part of your book, Radical. And I think I'd like to start with, were you surprised by Mayor Fenty's defeat in the primary, and to what do you attribute it?
So I am a little embarrassed to say that I was the only person in the entire city that was surprised by the defeat. I'm such a huge believer in Adrian Fenty. I mean, I work with this man every single day, and I could not have asked for a better champion and a better boss and a better sort of leader. And it just didn't compute in my head, because the way that I was looking at it was, okay, in the last 3 years, we have raised student achievement levels in this short period of time more than the district had seen in the 15 years before that all combined together. He had pushed, you know, homicide levels down to the lowest in 40 years. The population was growing in D.C. It was safer, cleaner, you know, much more efficient. And I just thought, who's going to vote against that? And I was 100% wrong. In fact, my husband, who came out to campaign for Fenty before the election, you know, was going door to door, all parts of the city. And at one point he said, we might be in some trouble. Because he was talking to sort of everyday people. And what we realized was that people cared a whole lot more about the process than the results. Because we just assumed if we produce these outsized results, then who's not going to want them to continue? But people cared a lot about how the personality of how those things were getting done. And so at the end of the day, he lost. I think if I were to say why, I would say that in large part, it was because of the reforms that we did. And what the reforms did was it allowed the opposition to create a narrative that he doesn't care, he doesn't listen, he's a dictator, because we did these things so rapidly and because he wasn't swayed by the political winds. When we needed to close 23 schools, he supported me in doing that, and he wasn't, you know, listening to sort of all the people that were pulling him in other directions. But it allowed people to create this narrative about him. And this was, I think, the most interesting thing about it was that some polling was done in the city right before the election. And one of the most interesting things that the poll showed was that confidence in the school district was at a historic high. More people than ever before in the history of the poll believed that the schools were heading in the right direction, and they had confidence that things were getting better. But what I realized was that they liked what was happening. They just didn't like the people who were making it happen. And so that was a big lesson for us.
Help us more with that. What was it about the process you ran that you think people reacted to so strongly?
And so this is, I will say, a big piece to it, because I am very, very confident that the things that we did were the right things. Cutting the central office bureaucracy in half, closing low-performing schools, giving parents more options through vouchers or charter schools so that every kid could get a high-quality education, you know, firing ineffective employees. Those were all absolutely the right actions to take. What I now realize is that how you do things is just as important as what you do. And that's where we fell short. And I'd say one example, which I'm a little embarrassed about, but it's been on national TV, so I might as well talk about it. Because people ask me about it a lot. I let a film crew follow me around and sort of track my movements, et cetera, as they were talking about what we were doing. And they were in a meeting where I fired a principal. And so it sort of caused an uproar, not just in the city, but sort of nationally. This lady is nuts, and she just fired somebody on national TV, and, you know, that sort of thing. And what I realized afterwards is, should that teacher or should that principal have been fired? Absolutely. That school was abysmal. I mean, if you looked at what was happening to the children in that school, no one would say that that should continue. Should he have been fired? Yes. Should I have done it on national TV? Probably not. So that's a little bit about the kind of what versus the how of things.
There are a couple of questions about what you would do differently if you had the chance to do D.C. again, besides not letting a film crew be there at that moment. Are there other things that you'd point to that you would have done differently?
Yeah. I'd say I made tons of mistakes and had lots of shortcomings, and I could talk for an hour just about all of those things. But one of our biggest challenges was that I was very, very naive going in and very unknowledgeable about the impact that our actions were going to have on sort of the broader community. So I thought my job was to run the school district. So I'm going to put my head down, and I'm going to make the decisions, and I'm going to put the policies in place and the programs, and I wasn't thinking about PR or communications or anything like that. So when, you know, reporters would call me, I'd pick up the phone and I'd answer the questions, and they'd, you know, ask me some things like, well, you know, do you think that there are some bad teachers in the district? And I'd say, yeah. And they'd say, well, what should you do about them? And I'd say, fire them. And then, you know, that would be the fire them was the headline, right? And it was because I was doing the sort of day-to-day work, and I had no clue about sort of the external communications piece of it. And I thought that the work would speak for itself, and that, of course, that everybody would understand why we were letting ineffective teachers go. But I wasn't out there constantly communicating that to people. The opposition, though, was communicating very, very effectively. They were saying, she is anti-teacher. She is, you know, she's trying to push veteran teachers out of the system because they're more expensive. I mean, they had their narrative that was set, and they were pushing it out aggressively. And in the void or vacuum of the fact that I wasn't out there saying anything, that took hold, and it became fact. And that was 100% my fault. I mean, that was on me to have, I should have known that was sort of part of sort of the overall picture of what we were doing. Now, that you have to have balance in everything, right? Because some people say, well, you know, what we want to do what Michelle did. We just want to be nicer about it, you know, that sort of thing. And I always say, okay, let me know if that works. because I think, you know, one of the things that Fenty was criticized most for, which was sort of what people would say was a tenure politically, it's what gave me the authority to be as aggressive as I wanted to be, because he wasn't listening to everybody who was in his ear saying, don't close down that school, don't let her fire that principal, you know, that sort of thing. So the question is what the balance is. And we did not strike the right balance in D.C., but that doesn't mean that the right balance can't be struck. It's just a matter, I think, of seeing what we did right and what we did wrong, learning from that and trying to strike the balance, knowing that other people have tended too much in the other direction, which is you want to please everybody so you're not moving aggressively enough.
I need to remind our radio audience again that our guest today is former Washington, D.C. Schools Chancellor Michelle Rhee, who is giving her perspective on how to improve education in America. Now, as you mentioned earlier, you have attracted some fairly severe critics.
Yes.
So I need you to respond to one of them, and I've picked one that perhaps one of your harshest, Diane Ravitz, research professor at NYU, and she argued that your tenure in Washington, D.C. was, she leveled charges of, quote, cheating, teaching to bad tests, institutionalized fraud, dumbing down of tests, and a narrowed curriculum. How do you respond to critics like that and to Diane specifically?
Yeah. So I would say that, I mean, I could take those apart one by one, but let me just take one. So this belief that there was a narrowing of the curriculum, actually it was exactly the opposite. Going through the school closure process where we closed 23 schools, and lots of people like Dan and Ravitz, they don't want to close any schools. They think that closing schools is just terrible because, you know, what about the role that that school plays in the community? I mean, these schools were failing schools where 10% of the kids in that school were on grade level. I think if you don't shut that down, I think it's almost criminal. But people like her want to, you know, keep those schools open. When we closed the 23 schools in D.C., what it allowed us to do was take our same budget and spread it over fewer schools, which meant that all of a sudden there were a whole lot more resources because we were no longer spending money to heat and light and air condition half-empty buildings. So through that school closure process, we were able to ensure that every single school in the District of Columbia had an art teacher, a music teacher, a PE teacher, a librarian, a nurse, and a guidance counselor or social worker for the first time in the history of the city. So it was not a narrowing of the curriculum. It was actually a broadening of the curriculum, because before we did that, whether or not a school had a music teacher depended on whether you were in the part of town where the parents could hold an auction that would then allow us to buy a music teacher, versus if you were in the other side of town where those kinds of resources were not there. We equalized the resources and the exposure that all children had to a broad-based curriculum. Take the cheating thing for another thing. There were allegations that there was cheating on tests going on in the district. And I actually acknowledge the fact that my immediate response was not a good one, because I sort of took it personal, as a personal affront. Like, are you saying that our kids actually can't learn at high levels? But that was actually the wrong thing to do. What I should have done, and later sort of corrected myself to do, was say, if there's any questions, then we should have a full investigation and whatnot. There have now been 5 investigations into that allegation of cheating in D.C., 3 by external entities, 1 by the Office of the Inspector General of the City of D.C., and 1 federal investigation by the U.S. Department of Education in conjunction with the Justice Department. All 5 of them find exactly the same thing, which was that there was no widespread cheating in the district and that there were problems in one particular school. Now, despite the fact that that is the case, there are still people who want to sort of continue that narrative, and I don't think there's a whole lot that we can do about it.
There are several questions about what you would advise others who face some of the problems that you would have. Let's take a superintendent first, a superintendent of a big city school system. How would you recommend that they take their job at this point?
So I will actually quote again Joel Klein on this one. When I was on the job for about 3 months in D.C., I was driving home one late night. It was raining. I'm in my car, and my phone rings, And I saw it was Joel Klein. So I pull over to the side of the road. I answer the phone. I said, "Yes, sir." And he said, "So how you doing?" And I was going through the school closure process at the time. So I said, "It's a little rough, but I'm hanging in there." He said, "Okay, I have two pieces of advice for you." I said, "Okay, I'm ready." And he said, "The first one is," he said, "do you have a boyfriend?" And at the time I didn't. So I said, "No, sir, I do not." And he said, "Okay, well, go out and get one." He said, "Because this is the loneliest job you can imagine." He said, "It's just hard. You get beat up every day." He said, "The only reason why I survive it is because my wife is there in bed next to me at the end of every night. And she says to me, 'Don't worry, baby. You're not the crazy one. They're the crazy one. You keep going.'" He said, "Without that support, I'd go nuts. So go find yourself a boyfriend." And I said, "Okay." And I did. And his second piece of advice, I said, "Okay, what's next?" And he said, "You have to lead from the front." And he said it in such a convincing way that, you know, it meant so much that I said, "Okay, I got it." And I hung up the phone and I got back on the road and I was like, "I have no idea what that means." And it wasn't until a few months later when that whole process had sort of closed out that I realized what he was talking about. About a year after the school closure process, this woman came up to me in one of the schools that we had closed one school and consolidated it with another. And so I walk into the new consolidated school and this lady walks up to me and she said, hey. She said, "Remember me?" She's like, "I was the lady that was always yelling at you at the community forums about the school closures." And I said, "Oh, I remember who you are. I didn't forget." She said, "I just wanted to let you know you were right." She said, "We couldn't see it at the time because it was an emotional process when we were angry at you. And this was a piece of our community that you were closed and it seemed disrespectful." She's like, "But I understand because now, like, this school is actually better. We have so much more in this school than we ever had in the other school. So I just wanted to let you know you were right." And I said, "See, no one's covering that. The Washington Post wasn't there to hear that one." But it instilled in me sort of the need that lead from the front is that if you get mired in the mess of everybody wants pulling you in five different directions, they might not have been able to see the benefit that was going to come from that process. I knew, though. I knew what was going to happen on the other end if we were successful and if we stood strong on doing that, the benefit was going to come. Mm-hmm. They couldn't see it at the time, but that's what leading from the front is all about. Sometimes you have to be out in front. If you do it right, other people eventually are going to be able to come along. But if you're in the middle or the back, you just can't get as much.
The next two questions are about how you advise political elected officials, and one is a big city mayor. How you might advise that person. The other is a governor, maybe Jerry Brown today. What advice would you have for them about education?
I'm having a whole lot more success with the mayor than I am with the governor right now. The mayor is fully there.
Let it be known by the radio audience that Michelle's husband, the mayor of Sacramento, California, is in the audience.
I would say this, we actually, and this is because of the work of my husband, we are seeing a lot more movement amongst mayors in this country than we are probably at any other level of government. And you know, so my husband is the chair of the U.S. Conference of Mayors Committee on Education, Arne Duncan's Task Force on Mayors, and the National Conference of Black Mayors Education Committee as well. And what he has been working on with his colleagues across the country is that they understand probably better than any other elected official the fact that if you don't have great schools, you can't have a great city. You can't attract the Fortune 500 businesses and all into your community if their workers and their executives aren't going to have a good place to send their kids. You can't attract small businesses to your downtown core if they feel like it's unsafe or they can't find skilled labor, et cetera. It all triangulates back to education. And I think because of that, he has been able to work with these folks to take positions on these issues that we literally, I think before this work started, we weren't seeing. And in particular, I'd say that his work with Democratic mayors. So over the last few years, you've seen people like Antonio Villaraigosa, Cory Booker, Frank Jackson in Cleveland. I mean, Rahm Emanuel. These are people who are icons of the Democratic Party. And they are now willing to take a stand, sometimes in opposition to what the unions want, to say, we have to push this for our kids, for our communities. It's not that we're anti-union or anything else. These are just the right policies to adopt. So we see much, much more movement from mayors. I'd say the governors have been a little tougher. The Republican governors are there. I mean, they see these issues playing out. And the cool thing is that we've been actually able to couple in lots of states like Ohio a Republican governor with a Democratic mayor to push legislation through that would give that mayor more power over his school district. We did that in Ohio in a bipartisan way. But I'd say where we still have a lot of work to do is with our Democratic governors.
One of our members of the audience wants to know whether this is educational reform is a Democratic issue, a Republican issue. How do students first approach this?
So I am clear in my book and in all my speaking that my husband and I are strong Democrats. We always have been. We always will be. But I am also incredibly, not just willing, but I think it is a necessary piece to this puzzle to work across the aisle. And so many of the politicians that we work most closely with at Students First are conservative Republicans. And I will say this about the sort of the partisan issues, and I'll speak from my own experience here. So as a Democrat, I had very clear views about what education reform should look like and what it shouldn't look like. And where I drew a really bright line was around vouchers, right? Because the Democratic, we don't like vouchers. Vouchers take money away from the schools that need it the most, and it throws a life preserver out to a few kids, and what about the other kids? All that stuff. I bought into it lock, stock, and barrel. So when I got to D.C., there was a publicly funded voucher program in place that served a few thousand kids, and it was up for reauthorization. And people wanted me to weigh in. They said, you're the top education official in the city. We want to know what you think about this. And I knew what I thought, but I thought, okay, well, I should at least talk to folks about it and make sure that I have my points clear. And what I did was I talked to mothers across the city who had done everything that we would want a mother to do. So they first researched their neighborhood school, found out that, 10% of the kids at that school were on grade level, said, my kid has a 90% chance of failure if I send him there, not acceptable. Then they did the second best thing that we recommended, which they would apply through the out-of-boundary lottery process to try to get a spot at one of the good schools across town. Inevitably, they'd be rejected because there were thousands of people applying and only a handful of spots. And then these moms would come to me and say, okay, now what do I do? And when I was looking eye to eye with these moms who wanted nothing for their children more than what I want for my kids, I thought, I don't have a space at a high-performing D.C. public school for this lady to send her kid to, at least not a school that I would send my own kid to. So who am I to deny this woman a $75, $100 voucher, which, by the way, was a whole lot less than what we were spending per kid in the district, and she could go to a Catholic school across the street, and her kid might be able to get a great education and be able to escape poverty? I'm not standing in the way of that. So I came out in favor of the voucher program. People went nuts. Like, you're going against the party, all this sort of stuff. And people probably who were most unhappy were my biggest supporters, because they said to me, Michelle, we actually, for the first time in a long time, we have hope that you are going to be able to do something to change this system. But you have to give yourself a chance. You got to have all the resources and all the money. You can't let the kids go, and then you're going to lose all. And I said, here's the problem with your thinking. My job is not to protect and preserve a system that has been doing a disservice to children. My job is to make sure that every kid in the city gets a great education. I am agnostic as to the delivery mechanism, right? So I'm trying to bring some of my fellow Democrats along with this. Not so successful. I was talking to my friend the other day who's a teacher, and she said, I explained everything that I explained to you. And I said, so what do you think? She looks at me and she goes, yeah, no. I don't buy it. I said, okay, let me try one more thing. I said, Waiting for Superman, you watch that movie? And she said, yes, one of my best friends was in it. So if you haven't seen the movie, there's this scene in the movie. So it's almost, you know, it's very sad, where this little girl is in the window of her apartment crying because she can't go to school because her mom has fallen behind on the tuition payments. And so I said to my friend, that scene with Bianca, where she can't go to her kindergarten graduation because her mom is down $500 because her hours got cut back from work. What do you think about that? My friend says, it was heart-wrenching. It was an injustice. I wanted to write the check myself. I said, right, honey, that would be a voucher. So here's my point on this is, if we stopped looking at things from this political party or that political party and just started thinking about things in terms of individual children, or in fact our own children, what decision would we make for our own children? Raise your hand if you were zoned to a failing school, if you would not take advantage of an opportunity to take some money and go to a better school. Not a single person would say yes to that. So if we wouldn't do that for our own kids, then who are we expecting to take that stance? So if we were to do that and say, what decisions could we make that would be good and right for kids? Then I guarantee you that we would have not a Republican agenda or not a Democratic agenda. We would have a students first agenda, which would move the trajectory of this country significantly.
Let me use the remaining 10 minutes to address. Let me ask you to comment on four developments in education that there have been many questions about. The first you started to get into, which is charters, a word you didn't use, but not just vouchers, but enabling more charters. How do you feel about that as a part of educational reform?
So I am a huge fan of effective charter schools. And I think that the charter school movement in this country has produced some schools that do unbelievable things for kids, but in particular poor and minority kids. So you see schools today across the Bay Area, like KIPP and Sacramento, like St. Hope, my husband started, where these schools are closing the achievement gap with kids that we 10 years ago would have thought can never sort of achieve at those levels. They're making it happen. So that more has to happen, and we should be doing everything that we possibly can to allow those schools to expand and grow to scale. There are also some crappy charter schools in California, in the Bay Area, across this country, and we need to close those schools down. There is, in the charters, or the whole notion behind charters to begin with was they were going to have increased authority and autonomy for increased accountability. But where we are right now is they have the authority and the autonomy, and we're not holding them accountable. And part of the problem with that is that the low-performing charter schools, they mask the performance of the great ones. And if we actually shut the poor ones down and let the great ones go to scale, then you would see a sector that looked very, very different from the traditional public school sector. So I think that I'm for effective charters, but we have to have the accountability structures in place.
1 minute answers on the others,
okay,
if I
I'm
may.
Go.
Pre-kindergarten programs in the Obama initiative for very young children, guaranteeing them access to school.
Yes. Earlier we can get them in the school, the better. I mean, our children in the inner cities come with significant challenges every day. And what we know is that if we can have them earlier, and we can, you know, from the time that they are 3 years old, we can be working with them full day on the skills that they need. Then by the time they get to be 5 years old, which was when they would normally come into school, they will be much, much better off if we have high quality early childhood programming. If what we set up is essentially babysitting centers, not a good use of dollars.
National core standards.
Like them. Here's the bottom line. The kids who are growing up in San Francisco today are not going to be competing for jobs against the kids in Sacramento or Memphis or Nashville. They are going to be competing for jobs against the kids in India and China and Singapore. That means we have to have internationally benchmarked standards that all American kids are expected to achieve at this level, which will allow them to compete in the global marketplace. This is a no-brainer. If you allow local jurisdictions to set up their own standards, which is what lots of people want to do these days, you will inevitably end up with an environment where the people in Compton are saying, oh, our second graders should learn in math addition and subtraction of basic facts, and the kids in Beverly Hills are being held to a standard where they're multiplying and dividing fractions. That, you cannot have that kind of inequity.
Favorite for the Bay Area, the Khan Academy and use of online resources to supplement, back up, teaching in the schools.
So let me just say, as a mother of a 14-year-old who has now moved on to math that I can no longer help her with, that the Khan Academy is like my savior, because she shows me the math problem, I'm like, dang, I don't remember how to do that. And then we go online and we click on, and these lessons, I don't know, if you haven't seen them, you should. They are brilliant. I mean, clear, concise. They walk the kid through the problem. I think that it shows what is possible in the future. One of the things that somebody asked me the other day, they said, well, there's, you know, 3.6 million teachers in America, and what if you found out that, you know, you could only find 2 million really great, highly effective teachers, then you're going to have 1.6 million that aren't as good, what are you going to do with them? I said, well, maybe. Or maybe we could reconceptualize how we deliver education, because I am telling you by watching these videos that they can serve as an enormous tool for educators across the country and for kids across the country. And the notion that the only way that we can do this is by having the same 24-to-1 ratios, et cetera, and not using technology, I think is going to be, will hinder our progress moving forward.
Efforts to professionalize teachers. I assume the question is referring to extra efforts in teacher training programs, in master's and credentialing programs. Are there efforts that you're aware of that are seeking to ratchet up the professionalization in the training of teachers themselves?
So let me just see that. Like, when I hear all that kind of stuff, my brain just starts to wander. I don't know what all that stuff means. If we were to really elevate the teaching profession, we have to begin to honor and respect teachers for the incredible work that they are expected to do every day. And let me tell you that it is the hardest and most important job that we have. My husband and I the other day were having a conversation because we were watching a basketball game, and I was commenting, you know, these guys get paid $12 million a year to dribble a ball around. I see no value that they are adding to society. He said, hey, that paid for that TV. But my point was, if anybody should be getting paid $12 million a year, it should be the most highly effective teachers in our nation. Because impacting the lives and the futures of children, there is no more important profession in our entire country. And we don't value teachers, we don't respect them, we don't create the kind of environment where we are paying them for the incredibly important work that we're doing. So to me, it's about how does society view the profession. That's one of the most important things that has to happen.
We have just 1 minute for a final question, which is that in Students First, you have an objective to empower parents. What does it mean to empower parents to promote educational reform and the education of their own children?
Sure. So this is an interesting one. In fact, I've never been involved in a conversation about education reform where this question hasn't come up. And normally it's sort of along the lines of, well, if we had better parents, then we'd have better kids, and then we'd have better schools, right? And I can tell you from having traveled across this country and talked to parents everywhere that I have never, ever met a mother anywhere who wanted anything different for her kids than I want for mine. What is different is the tools and the strategies that each parent has to be able to navigate the system, right? So some parents, they don't know that you can go to school and demand something different, or they do and they're sort of poo-pooed or whatever. And I mean, I would say this, two things. One is, one of the things that's going on right now in California is something called the parent trigger, which allows parents whose kids attend a failing school, if 51% of them sign a petition, they can force the turnaround of that school. The same people who are arguing that if we had better parents and we'd have better kids and we'd have better schools, and what the problem is not anything except the parents, are the same people who don't want the parent trigger to be enacted. Which to me is like, wait. If you want parental involvement, then you can't limit that to baking brownies and cutting out letters. If you want parent involvement, then you better get ready for the parents to be involved, including holding you accountable for crappy efforts. So that's the one piece of it. The second piece of it that I feel like we cannot forget, parent involvement matters. The research shows this. When parents are more involved, the kids do better, the schools do better, without a doubt. So we have to do everything that we can to make sure that more parents are involved in our schools. But the bottom line is that we have kids throughout this country who have parents who just aren't going to do the right thing. They're not going to be involved in their kids' lives. They're not going to come to school. They're not going to ask the right questions. So the question that we need to ask ourselves as a society is, what about those kids? Because what I would argue is that to subjugate those children to lower expectations, lower quality education, that then is going to impact their life chances and their life outcomes, that's the biggest injustice imaginable. We cannot hold children responsible for something that they have absolutely no control over, which is who their parents are and what they decide to do. If we're going to live up to our ideals as a country, we have to create a public school system that ensures that it doesn't matter what color your skin is, where you live, in what zip code, and even what your parents do. If you work hard and you do the right thing, you can still live the American dream.
I want to thank you. Our thanks to Michelle Rhee, founder and CEO of Students First, former chancellor of the District of Columbia school system, and author of the new book, Radical, Fighting to Put Students First. We also thank our audiences here at the Commonwealth Club and on radio, television, and the Internet. This program has been part of the club's Good Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. We also want to remind everyone here that copies of Michelle Rhee's new book are on sale in the lobby, and she would be pleased to sign them outside this room immediately following the program. We would appreciate your letting her move out to that spot after we conclude the session. I'm Professor Kirk Hansen, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.